Dan.
How's it going?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm great. Doing good. Everything's great. Everything's fine.
Mm-hmm,
everything
no
is awesome.
No problems.
Everything is cool when you're doing a show.
Mm-hmm.
You probably don't spontaneously break out into song when you're talking throughout the day nearly as often as I do you?
I don't really know how often you do.
All the time. Most of the time it's because you're reciting a child's YouTube video that has been burned into your brain day after day.
Mm.
But sometimes it's just like the melody of it gets stuck in your head and you start just singing, you know, let's eat our Cheerio, whatever it's going to be. I don't know, but it happens.
Is that one of the songs?
No, it's not. Actually, at this point, everything is awesome stuck in my head, which is good because I don't have any Miss Rachel's tune stuck in my head right now, but I'm sure they'll pop up halfway through the show.
Who's Miss Rachel?
Don't worry about it.
Who's Miss Rachel?
She's a delightful lady who does the YouTubes, and she's the third co-parent in any modern family these days.
Sounds complicated.
Yeah, she's a childhood educator or something. She sings songs and teaches things and words and stuff.
Hmm. And you have her song stuck in your head.
Yeah. Just hours and hours and hours of them.
If I say Miss Rachel, uh-huh, what's the first one of Miss Rachel's songs that comes to your mind?
We don't want to do this.
Do it.
No, we don't want to do this.
Do it for your audience, Dan.
I shan't.
Okay. Party pooper.
Hey, what's so wrong with this particular car comp here? Aside from it looks like a person on a bicycle is moving twice as fast as the car is.
Yeah. Also, I don't know if you noticed, but the glass is not very glassy. It's got a gradient edge on it.
I mean, that's the light highlight hitting the edge of the open glass, isn't it?
No, that's not how that works, because it's glass, so it would be a defined highlight from the edge of it, not something like soft and fuzzy. They don't airbrush glass highlights. Anyway.
No, but it's the window's rolled down.
Yeah, it's only partially rolled down.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't see a smooth, blurry edge.
What if it's a really old window? Some of those old windows got that like weird polished edge to them.
Okay, sure. In any event, I am not thoroughly impressed by this here.
Mm-hmm. What if it's an LED wall and you're just like, you're going to have to take all of that back?
Eat crow? Yeah, I mean,
I've never liked that phrase. I don't understand that. I don't want to.
There's a reason for it, and I don't remember what it is, and I don't want to look at it. Look it up right now, but anyway,
I'll ask the ChatGPT rope.
Okay, does Miss Rachel have a Eat Crow song?
There's birds and things, but no, not so much. Eat crows and idiomatic mistakenly accept million. Yeah. Expression of simple situation. Origin of the phrase is somewhat unclear, but it is thought to date back to the 19th century. Eating a crow, which is generally considered to be a distasteful or an appetite. It doesn't tell me anything. Eating a crow is unpleasant and distasteful. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Who are these people eating crows?
I think the goal is you don't want to eat the crow.
Why would anyone eat the crow?
No one wants to eat the crow.
Everyone's like, oh, you said a wrong thing. You got to eat the gross bird. That's not how things work.
I know, but that's the thing. It's just like, you don't want to eat crow. You don't want to be wrong. That's the thing.
Being wrong and eating a gross bird, those things are not equivalent.
No, but it's like, because you're saying like, I'll do this terrible thing if I'm wrong. And, you know, like I'll eat crow or whatever, but this is the thing.
I don't agree. I don't buy it because there would be an A in there. I would eat a crow.
Well, I mean, it's old, so it's probably like old English, like ye olde crap English. But like, you're familiar with the phrase, I'll eat my hat. It's the same thing. I don't have a hat on right now, so it's kind of an empty threat to the hat. But I very much feel like Fincher is using a large amount of screens that are various chroma colors in his little picture that he's made here. And I got to be perfectly honest with you, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
When you suggested this movie to me, I had no idea it existed. I had never heard of it or anything about it.
Really?
No,
I mean, there was a very small marketing promotion for it many months ago. And then at one point, like I think last month, I was like, oh, right, I should go watch that Fincher movie. And I popped it up and was like, it's still not out yet? Like, because they just stopped marketing it. I was like, oh, and then they ramped it up for the last like week or two right before it, where it's like, coming out next week or whatever. Like, oh, okay, I guess I got to wait one more week. But yeah, they really did not talk that much about this movie. I mean, I remember when the original trailers come out, we're like, ooh, wow, there's a new David Fincher movie all of a sudden. I had heard nothing about this. I guess I'll look forward to seeing that in 2 months. And then it just kind of entered the world without much to do.
I think my favorite part was when I hit play. And then I found out it was a David Fincher movie because it just launched right into the credits. And I had no idea before then.
You didn't know it was a Fincher movie?
No idea. I'd never heard of it at all in any context. I'm not a Fincher head like you are.
Well, I mean, yeah. It's not so much that I'm a Fincher head. It's just that I follow Eric Messerschmidt on Instagram. So I'm going to get all of the Fincher that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to say that you're definitely not infatuated with the every little move of David Fincher is following Eric Messerschmidt, but whoever
cinematography Instagram is for photos. He posts pretty pictures.
Oh, well, if he had shot some pretty pictures for this movie, that'd be good too.
Wow, sir.
This movie looks like crap. It looks like a made-for-TV BBC production.
I don't think the cinematography contributes to the made-for-TV look of the movie. But that's,
okay.
There are other things that contribute to that, but we can get there when we get there if you'd like to talk about the cinematography first.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's start at the beginning. There's the Netflix N, and then immediately into animated title stuff with your
it's the most Marvel-y David Fincher credits you've ever seen. It's very odd.
It doesn't mesh with anything. It comes out of nowhere. It just starts going and then it just stops just as abruptly. It doesn't integrate with anything, and you think like perhaps it's thematically tied to something with the images that they're using in the credit sequence, but it's just like grenades and guns and things, and it's like
it's assassin. Yeah, it's like oh, you haven't seen Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The opening credit sequence of that is very dramatic and also kind of not sort of related to the movie, but just like imagery and stuff. But the credits just kind of come out of nowhere. They feel like an overdone TV series. Do you want to get into this before we talk about what actually happens in the movie, or do you want to like talk about what happens in the movie and then get into all of the things around the movie? Because there's a lot. There's a lot to discuss about the movie outside of the plot, because I'm confused by a lot of things here.
I think we can talk about the outside of the movie after. We can kind of guess along our way of being like, whoa, what the F is that supposed to mean? But let's start with we'll just hit the ground running and explain what's happening here. And if anyone is you got this on their bingo card or whatever for David Fincher, for like your punch card for Free for IO or something, and you really need to see this movie first, go ahead and do it. Just know I rated it, I think 2 stars on Letterboxd, and I don't know, Dan, you gave it like what, 3.5 or 4 or something?
3.5. This is a 3.5 on my scale. And to be honest, this would be a 3 movie if it weren't for the craft involved with it, which again, I don't know that this, spoiler alert for later or whatever, this does not rise to the level of a David Fincher movie in my eyes, even though it is a David Fincher movie, but there is still a fair amount of expert craft on display here. But if this had been anyone else, this would be a 3 or 2.5 movie for me.
It feels like a David Fincher knockoff movie.
It kind of does, but also, I mean, like somebody who's like really good at a David Fincher knockoff, because there are David Fincher knockoffs that are not even this good.
Well, who is his second unit? Is it, do you think it was mainly his second unit guy?
I don't know, actually. I feel like he's not really a second unit guy. Well, again, historically, he's not really a second unit guy because he's so
hands-on and detail-oriented. But nothing about picky. This movie, nothing about this movie feels picky or hands-on or detail-oriented.
No, so much. I mean, okay. So one of the other things about this, I think I mentioned to you when I first suggested we see the movie, is that I had been seeing a lot of not-so-great reviews about it. It's right up our alley, right? But like one of the reviews that I saw that is just embedded in my brain, because I didn't want it to be true, but I think it's probably true, was just, I think the entirety of the review was, sometimes even David Fincher has to punch a clock. And it's like, I mean, he doesn't, like, he shouldn't, right? Like, there's no need. I mean, we could talk about, like, where he sits in the pantheon of directors and, you know, what his reputation must look like to studio heads whom he's asking to fork over millions of dollars for the things that he makes. But, like, he didn't need to do this movie, and he didn't need to do it this way, did he? Like, there's, like, why... Whatever, I'll save it for later, but, like, I don't understand why this movie exists the way it exists, or frankly why it even exists at all, to be honest. But anyway, yeah, it was, sure. Well, where were we?
Let's just get through the opening scene, and then if you really need to there, you can get off your chest. Sure. I just want to help set the scene for the audience who may not feel like watching it first, to just kind of explain how jarring it is when you start watching this film. Or at least it was jarring for me. I don't know if it was kind of confusing, perhaps.
It was jarring. There's like a weird fast pace, but also not like an interesting fast pace. It's just like, let's get through these credits with these weird images real quick, and then we can show you the movie. And it's going to start with a long, slow push in this empty office, and show you basically the one scene that you've already seen from all of the trailers, which is Michael Fassbender sitting in a chair looking out of a window.
Yeah. And I should say that the credits, while kind of perplexing because they just come out of nowhere and they immediately abruptly end, have some energy to them, also helped by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's score under the credits. But then the movie happens, and for like, what, 15 minutes, all we have is Michael Fassbender's voiceover, which he delivers in a completely even monotone the entire time. He does not talk to anyone, really, other than having, what was it, like a couple words on the phone with Hedges. And that's it. Like, the whole entire time, it's just mainly him sort of like scowling or looking like... unsettled, I guess, or like a psycho, but he like a killer. But he is just doing that for an extended period of time, with no acting work involving people, no one to talk to or be with or explain things to or have things explained to him. There's no conversation at all occurring. We know that he's there watching a window, and he's going to shoot someone who will eventually appear in that window. And there's a
modicum of sort of wit to some of his voiceover. Like, you get eventually that he's got these sort of like cool hitman guy phrases that he recites to himself. And like, when we get to the actual end of this assassination attempt, you know, he kind of like, he realizes he's not as cool as he is, where he kind of catches himself off guard and says, well, that's new, you know, I screwed up or whatever. But, you know, he's talking about his stats, like, I'd be bad in 1,000. Except I'm not taking credit for some guy who had a heart attack in front of me, because that's not cool or whatever. Like, he's kind of talking himself up, and there's a little bit of, you know, witty bravado in there. I find the Popeye line to be extraordinarily stupid. I don't think that's fun or interesting in any way, but maybe that's just me and I'm joyless or something. But yeah, you're right. For the most part, he's just sort of describing... He's describing the life of a hitman, but also the life of a like borderline OCD kind of human being who entered this profession because he is capable of the reason he's good at his job is because he's okay sitting in a chair, staring out a window for a week straight, sleeping for 15 minutes an hour, every hour, and then just like being constantly vigilant, because he just has the, you know, the focus and wherewithal inside him to be, you know, the unflinching trigger man or whatever here, without bringing empathy and, you know, caring into the situation. He can just do the job. He's very good at the job that way. It's like, right, I get it. And maybe part of the struggle with this movie, and I swear I won't veer too far into the problem in general, but like, this is a hitman movie. Like, this is not new ground. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think any of these tropes are things that we haven't seen before. Like, we understand pretty quickly. Like, there's a fair amount of shorthand with assassins. Like, you get what the job is, and I appreciate that they lingered a little bit in the beginning of this movie on some of the tedium there, but there's a lot of it, and it's just, it's not different or interesting enough really in any way until he's, you know, basically complaining like, fine, I'll give it one more day and I'll pack up out of here. Or like, you know, the mail being thrown in through the door, like those brief moments like that. Is that enough to keep your attention for this opening 10 or 15 minutes? I don't know. Aside from watching, you know, Michael Fassbender, who is an extraordinary being who is great at being expressionless. That's the other thing, too. Like here, like the subject matter and the character fit very well together. But the way they fit together is that they are both just like emotionless, like just sort of like dead sticks of a human being. Like that's what the scene calls for. But it's also like not very fun to watch.
No. Yeah. And you are veering into the overall conversation that I completely agree with, by the way. It is not new or novel or any of that. And there's a lot of this that could be economized. A lot of his witty repartee is not that witty because it's not even repartee. He's just talking to himself. He's got mantras that he recites to motivate himself and to keep himself on track and stuff that he recites often throughout the film. It doesn't help in this medium to do that. I know that this is based on a French comic series, apparently. I looked that up afterwards, or it was in the credits, but then I checked on it after. And I can understand how in a comic book you'd have those little boxes where you write in what the character's thinking, and that works real well. In a movie, just having voiceover work with no other actors for him to bounce off of is kind of a waste. And it isn't an exclusive problem of this opening scene, but this opening scene kind of exemplifies the problem, which is why I wanted to discuss it. Also, the overall quality of how this is shot and put together is worrying, really, coming from David Fincher, because I am obsessed with this terrible window that they have in this set. He is inside of a WeWork that is either under construction or being gutted. I'm not sure. And the set has three windows. There's a center window that has our view out to the plaza that connects these Parisian apartments with their mansard roofs and stuff and their cobblestone street. And there's a little cafe and stuff. So there's that stuff going on out, but only through that one window that he's sitting in front of. And then the other two windows are identical and are spaced maybe 5 feet away from each other.
More like 10 or something, but yeah.
Okay. But they're not far apart. But all of the windows have a thin plastic film over them, but have just blue, solid blue behind them, except for the middle window where he has moved the plastic tarp out of the way and it is sort of folded like a dangling handkerchief on the side of the window. And you can see straight through the plastic. So they're not solid blue tarps. They just didn't key the windows on the left and the right side of the main window. And even that main window, they don't match the focus and they don't match the exposure correctly. And there are tracking bumps in it. And I don't understand how I'm supposed to be paying attention to the words this guy is saying when I'm watching stuff bounce out this window and go in and out of focus. It is so distracting. I do not understand what happened in the construction of this opening scene. When he goes outside and he sits on the park bench and he makes himself his little like McDonald's breakfast double down, then
gluten free, you got to take the bread off.
Yeah, when he does that, like that is interesting because he's out in the world interacting with something. He's not just in what is a very static set where you don't have any energy or action, and it is all just him sitting there. So I don't understand any of how this opening scene is written, and it kind of is a problem, like you said, with the rest of the film for other scenes where it doesn't make any sense. All the energy gets sucked out and we're just sitting there waiting for a thing to happen. And it does eventually happen, and he does eventually have the tent. There's that moment of tension where he's going to shoot the guy. We don't know why he's going to shoot the guy. It doesn't matter. But there's a dominatrix there, and the guy is real entertained by it. So he is lining up his shot and he's going to not shoot the dominatrix, but shoot the guy. And then he misses and shoots the dominatrix. And the guy survives and all chaos starts. And then he starts doing his rolling up everything, bleaching things, getting down to his electric moped thing that we saw earlier, you know, born ultimatuming his way out of there on his moped. Or I don't know, it's like an electric Vespa. I don't know what the deal is, but he goes to a gas station and then he's like scrubbing himself down and shaving and he cuts himself. And it's like, what is this, a plot point, or is he just like, or is it just supposed to be that he's so stressed out? And I guess just he's just so stressed out.
He's built his existence on perfection and he's off his game. But yeah, it's again, I'm trying not to go too far afield of what's happening in this movie, but David Fincher is a big fan of characters that are essentially blank slates, and I think Fassbender is like a great example of that, as a person who can essentially exist with no expression on his face, and you can sort of read into it whatever you want to read into his just performance. And that jives well with the assassin thing here too, but the circumstances here being as sort of rote assassin, why can't I think of the word? Just the repetitive and just the way that is so predictable, it doesn't help there. Like, I mean, even when he should get a little bit more flustered, he's still very robotic. But I guess that's just sort of the character we're building here. I don't know. And part of it, and maybe the comic book thing that you brought that up to, like, as an aside, I have never seen a movie based on like a written work before that has made me want to seek out the written work even less than this movie. Like, if this is the movie version of it, there's no way that the written version of this is entertaining in the slightest, right? Like, that's not, it can't possibly be interesting.
Well, I don't know. I feel the opposite way. I feel like a lot of times films can fail to capture the thing that made the book series or comic book series interesting. And it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes, you know, you can get an interesting movie that's more interesting, you know, more interesting than a book, but a lot of times they can really mess it up.
I don't see a glimmer in this movie that strikes me as something interesting enough about assassins that would be worth reading. Like, I mean,
well, but is that because I don't think they literally, I don't think this is a literal adaptation, because there's a lot of stuff in here that's written in the modern day. Airbnbs, WeWorks, like, this is adapted.
Yeah, I guess I didn't look at the writer. I thought the writer was associated with the comic book and was sort of bringing that expertise to it. Is that not the case?
No. And this is a comic book series that started in 1998, and is still going. Like, they're still making it, so it can't be that bad, or at least not as bad as this movie. But it's just one of those things where it's just like they didn't. I don't think they captured
this
whatever
is the
it
guy
was.
Who wrote Seven.
Hmm.
No, it's not.
Everybody needs a paycheck.
I guess, right.
Mm-hmm. And your favorite movie, Event Horizon.
No. Did he really?
Yeah. And Sleepy Hollow? I don't know. X-Men? Oh, no. His version of the X-Men wasn't picked up, I guess. So, yeah. Oh, he worked on the game. Oh, gross. I hate that movie.
I'm not seeing Event Horizon here. Is it here?
There's... Walker would not earn another film credit to his name for another 4 years, although he penned several uncredited rewrites during this period, including the game. Oh, so he did a rewrite on Event Horizon.
Yeah. I mean, but like everything you just listed there has so much more interesting story to it than this. I mean, like, I'm not trying to cliff notes what happens in this movie, but you can guess what happens in this movie. An assassin's job goes wrong. They try to, you know, kill him and everyone he knows to sort of like clean the record of his existence. He gets upset about that and he goes on a revenge spree. Like, that's nothing about that is interesting or new or novel.
Well, and it is kind of perplexing to me that it did not occur to anyone who was making the movie that it wasn't that interesting. I don't know why, because it seems obvious, like, to the two of us, because the second he goes and he sees that his girlfriend, I don't know, question mark. She was severely beaten and almost killed. I don't know why there was an almost killed. It all seemed very vague. The movie seemed uninterested in explaining to us why two assassins left her alive.
Because he certainly doesn't show the same sort of leniency to the taxi driver.
No.
So you think that's kind of the profession. Although, you know, the way Tilda Swinton makes it seem is just like, we showed up and you weren't there and your girlfriend was, so I thought we were going to leave, but he really wanted to beat her up. And it's like, who are you and what are you here for? Like, that's not how any of this stuff works. But yeah, like, there's not even, like, we're to understand that he loved his private life and he thought he was secure enough on his own, even though he's an assassin and, you know, boss probably knows where he lives. That he takes such offense to assassins coming to his home, destroying things and assaulting his girlfriend, that he may have otherwise just disappeared, but now he's so offended that he has to kill everyone involved with this potential sort of revenge. Like, that they broke his personal rules by showing up at his house and beating up his girlfriend. But he doesn't even, like, he doesn't even really express that sort of, you know, visceral anger that you would expect to come along with somebody feeling violated like that and having this sort of, you know, murderous skills to go after people in this sort of way. He's so measured all the way through that it doesn't feel right. Again, you know, you want to give people the benefit of the doubt and assume that some of this was intentional. You know, the idea being that he's just so mechanical and robotic that that's why he does this for a living or whatever. But, like, if we're meant to understand it, like, there's, like, a little bit of a mental, emotional break because they crossed a line beating up his girlfriend. Like, we need to see more of that. Like, I don't feel like we do.
Well, I feel like his emotional response is not in his... is not conveyed through his facial expression or the words that he uses or anything like that. His emotional response is conveyed through seeing him do the John Wick thing of digging up his passports and guns and, like, going to the thing and doing all that stuff. Like, that is his emotional response.
It's still just so fastidious. Like, he's digging a hole and he's sorting through Ziploc bags. Like, in John Wick, he was so pissed off he took a sledgehammer to a concrete floor and got some of its aggression out that way to get his stuff out of the ground. Like, Michael Fassbender is, like, digging up the grave of a cat that died or something. Like,
yeah, but that's exactly it, though, is, like, I completely agree with you. I'm saying what they're doing in this film is uninteresting in a film perspective. Like, why are we watching this? You know, is, like, it's one thing to say, like, this is a professional and he's, like, really into what he's doing and he's so professional about everything and he's by the book and he's measured and he has complete control of his emotions, but he's going to do this thing just like he's an assassin and now he's on his own mission. It's a revenge thing. There's so many movies about these kinds of revenge things.
And there's even, like, a music cue and we're intercutting scenes and it's still boring.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, is, like, you can say, like, on a technical level, like, this guy is so measured and in control, but in a film, in the world of cinema, why is an audience watching this happen? And I come down on the side of we would rather have something that might strain the boundaries of reality, because obviously, like, who cares? It's like we're, like, trying to, like, have some sort of, like, whole thing with, like, balance sheet and, like, how he got the passports and, like, that's not part of this movie at all anyways. So it's just, like, give us some emotion. His measured control of emotion means nothing to us in the audience. And it doesn't deliver on anything plot wise in this film, because he never is in a situation where his emotional or an emotional outburst would jeopardize him in some way.
There's very rarely any sort of feeling like he's not going to accomplish his goal, which is the other part of it too. Cause it's just like, once he makes the decision that, like, everyone has to die, he's like, okay, here's my to-do list. I'm going to slowly check these things off. And, you know, you get the fight scene with the brute, which is probably the closest thing where he sort of feels like he's met his match. But I mean,
Well, that's just because of the camera shake, Dan.
Well, sure. I mean, you knew he was getting beat up and was being harmed, but I did never feel like he was actually going to lose that fight at any point. But
at no point does it ever seem like he's going to not succeed in this film, which is annoying because...
Or perhaps it's a testament to how kind of easy it is to sneak up on people and murder them if you have a lot of resources and information. You got a lot of money and passports and guns and stuff laying around.
Yeah, but it has all the tension of watching an unwrapping video. Like, he's going to unwrap the package and it's going to be something inside the package. And like, that's what it is.
Like, I've seen how do you solve this weird puzzle cube TikToks that probably have more twists and turns and interest to them than this movie. You're like, he's an assassin. He's going to follow people around in his car. He's going to do some sneaky stuff with, you know, pretending to be somebody else. Or, you know, I liked the little key fob cloner, but like, get it or whatever. It's just not. There are no surprises here, really. And
there's, you know, none of these challenges stop him for more than 2 seconds. Because he's such a learned professional in this industry. So he's never challenged in any way by this stuff that causes him to have a setback, a major setback.
Aside from his own expectations or whatever, like when he puts the nails into Hodges or whatever, and he's like, I should live for 6 minutes or whatever. And then he's like, whoops-a-daisy, I guess I miscalculated again. So like, maybe it's time for him to retire because he's a little off his game. You know, he shot a dominatrix and he miscalculated how long three nails to the sternum would take to kill somebody. So he's slipping a little bit, but like his personality is still just like, you know, so robotic that it doesn't quite jive. Like watching this kind of person get slightly worse at their job or, you know, or with age or whatever it might be, is not particularly compelling because he's not exactly grappling with his abilities slipping. He's just pushing through to do the job.
Right. And so like the first thing he does, despite all this voiceover, he never explains really like his order of operations. But his first order of operations is to go to New Orleans, where he has a storage thing. And you're just like, okay, so is he just there for the storage thing? And then it's like, and then Dolores. And it's like, is Dolores doing, what does he know Dolores for? But then he's got his convoluted plan to get in there and get inside the office. And that's where Hedges works. And Dolores is like his assistant. And he zip ties Hedges to the chair and Dolores zip tie herself to the sink. And then they, do that thing, like you said, with the nail gun, where he expects to be able to get the answers out of Hedges, but Hedges dies. And instead, he has to get the answers out of Dolores. And there's a brief second where you think, well, maybe Dolores will live. And up to this point, Dolores is the most interesting person in the movie. The whole film is the only person that I have any kind of interest in is Dolores, because she's an employee of this corrupt organization and she knows things and she isn't a fighter and she wants to try to be able to survive this, and she's got her kids and stuff. And so you have,
or even if she doesn't want to survive, like it's interesting that she knows she's going to die and how she spends her last little bit of time, like giving this guy what he needs and asking for something in return. Like that's interesting. You know, I mean, it's not the most unique thing in you've ever seen, but like, please kill me in a way that my kids can still collect the life insurance is kind of a weird bargain to strike with an assassin that is out on a revenge spree.
Yeah. And I mean, it is just like sad once she dies, and not because of just death, but because she is more interesting to have there with him so that there is conversation in the film than when she is not there. And we go from that to Florida, where we have to deal with the Brute, who is the first operative that he got out of her Rolodex system. There's the Brute and the expert, who is Tilda Swinton, and then the final big boss is the client, who hired everyone to do all these things. So he's going after the Brute first in Florida, and the Brute stuff is very uninteresting to me because, again, there's very little in the way of dialogue, and there's nothing evocative about our scenery. I've seen more interesting stuff, like even in Magic Mike, you know, the Tampa Bay area looks more interesting than this. This stuff where there's just like a house and then they just get some jerky friends and then there's, you know, a pit bull. It's like, okay, well, there's that, I guess. Yeah,
I think the most useful thing about this scene, aside from giving us some sort of action fight scene, is that it shows us his overeagerness a little bit. Like he's just ready to get in there and kill this guy to the point that he's like, you know, he's walking in to this guy's house with a pistol basically and not really doing much homework. Like he opens the door and it has one of those chimes on it. It's like, bro, you're supposed to be like one of the best assassins out there. Shouldn't you just be like, in a van, like 100 yards away with a rifle, just waiting for this dude to walk past one of the crappy windows of his place? Like, what are you even doing there? And again, part of the point is that like, it's less about the job now. And it's about, you know, cause he says kind of in the beginning of the movie and at the end that he has the ability to kill people in ways that cause them lots of pain if they are so deserving of that sort of thing. So you can tell he kind of wants to get in there and return a little bit of the violence that the brute gave to his girlfriend. But it's ill-conceived because the brute is a very large man and you should just kill him and move on with your business. Because what is the point? What is the goal here? Is the goal just to kill all of these people so that you can go live in peace and not have to worry about retribution? If that's your goal, just, drop some C4 out of a helicopter or whatever. Like, don't even come anywhere near this guy. Like, you don't need to be in the vicinity of these people if you just need them gone so you can go be, you know, retired or whatever. But, you know, whatever. It's an action movie. And I don't want to begrudge the people who like this movie because they enjoyed the action and the ride of it or whatever. I don't agree with that particular opinion. I don't think this was a fun watch per se.
No, and the action isn't even that good. To be perfectly honest,
you know. Oh, again, as you've pointed out, I'll watch anything David Fincher does just to sort of get a sense of it because, you know, I'm scraping those crumbs out of the bottom of the David Fincher bag of potato chips or whatever. but you know. Yes, I have watched this movie. Checkbox. But like, so much of the occurrences here, particularly in the brute, they don't make any sense. Like, there's a little bit of the Tilda Swinton moment that follows the brute is a nice sort of catch your breath. Like, let's have a more intellectual, quiet version of the same sort of scene. And he kind of needs to catch his breath after just getting his ass kicked by this giant dude in Florida. But he didn't get his ass kicked hard enough in Florida to be as quiet and sort of still across the other side of the table from Tilda Swinton as he was. Like, at no point is he even sort of like goaded into the conversation with her. He sits there stone-faced the entire time. And you expect him to be sort of continuing to unravel a little bit as a person, you know, just sort of discovering something about himself or becoming a slightly different person or realizing he has changed. Like, you know, part of the reason that he's slipping at his job, whatever, is like he's started to become a different person without really noticing it or whatever. And like, he's going to start to embrace that or something towards the end of the movie. It's kind of like an existentialist thing where it's not quite the stranger where he's unfeeling at the beginning and he kind of feels and, you know, becomes a more well-rounded person later on. But, you expect more than just like sitting across the table staring at Tilda Swinton while she does her thing over there. Like I don't think that was quite executed, not executed, I should say. I don't think that was quite written the way it should have been for the impact that it could have had.
No, and I agree with you. 'Cause it turns into a one woman show, basically, because Tilda Swinton has to carry the entire scene, which she does, but it's not a movie about Tilda Swinton's character. She is in very little of this movie overall. So having her just monologue at him,
yeah,
it's like, what was the advantage of that?
And she's attempting to be a mirror for his character and sort of like help him come to some sort of revelations, but he doesn't take any of that with introspection. He just stares at her.
No, and what she says has no effect on him.
Yeah. Probably because like at the end when he sees the knife in her hand, he's like, haha, I knew I was right all along. And she was just full of crap. And it's like, well, kinda.
I mean, but it would have been more interesting personally, in my opinion, had she not been, you know, ready to stab him? I know that it seems like they want to say like, oh, well, he's just really smart and capable and he doesn't fall for that. And he didn't fall for her tricks. And it's like, yes. And I mean, the audience isn't rooting for her to live.
Right. I mean, it's like, where do you draw the line between like last ditch effort versus her just like being like, you know what? This is what we do for a living. It's, you know, like she said, like, I've thought about this moment so many times. Like, it's just like she's accepting of her fate to a point, but then also like, well, let me try one more time. Let's see if I can get a knife in this guy. Get out of here.
Yeah. I mean, it just it doesn't amount to anything. It's just her monologuing. And then he goes on unchanged, basically, from this.
The thing that he came there to do, ultimately, mm-hmm. the killing of Tilda Swinton, is the least interesting part of that whole sequence.
Yeah, and I thought it was... Tilda Swinton is a good actress, as we've discussed before. And sometimes she's in bad things, like Snowpiercer, and sometimes she's in good things. And this is one of those occasions...
Constantine.
This is one of those occasions where she's in a movie, and... nothing she's doing is bad. It's just the movie around her doesn't interface with it at all. Like she's just this little iceberg floating out there. And it's just like I wanted more like consequences or stakes or something. Like they just have a chat while she drinks whiskey and then he has a swig of whiskey and I was like, okay, fingers crossed for poison. Nothing happens. They go outside, they walk for like 2 seconds, she pretends to slip so that she can stab him, and he shoots her in the head and then sees the knife, and then it's just like, aha, there we go. And I don't get what the point of all of that is. Why did we go through the exercise as an audience again? Like, I can understand that if you are trying to say like, this guy is such a professional, he's not going to fall for her tricks. Like, sure, fine, go ahead and do that. But why are we watching a movie about that? Because that is so uninteresting. And we go from that to Chicago with the final, the big boss with Claiborne. Maybe it's Maybelline, but
he's got an OU there.
All right. So Claiborne, he is in Chicago and he is this overconfident business guy who I guess is up to something nefarious because he hired an assassin, but who knows? We don't really get a sense of, we don't need an explanation why he's bad, why he wants to kill anybody, why he wants to do anything. It doesn't matter. But he's this powerful guy with money. And he is in a position where he's protected or more protected by other people around him because of his resources. But he himself is weak. And there's a, you know, a bunch of stuff where it's like he's going through all of the Fassbender's going through all the like little puzzle things to like get us across the finish line to get into the room with him. And it's boring and tedious. And at no point is he like, is there even a moment of tension of him being caught? He just kind of like knows which boxes to check. He watched the movie already and wrote down the steps he needed to take. He watched the playthrough or whatever on YouTube. And so
there are brief glimpses of like, you could see him potentially ending up in a situation where he might have to try and explain himself or work himself out of it. But like, he never actually ends up in those situations. So it's more just like, you're imagining what could potentially happen to him, and then maybe that's where the tension is supposed to come from. But there's only so much that we as the audience can bring to our part of this interaction here, and we can't provide the tension from things that aren't happening. Like, that's too much.
Yeah, it just isn't like, I don't know, it's there's, you know, Fincher's known for his thrillers and stuff and other things, and there's nothing thrilling here happening. He's just checking boxes, and then he finally gets to that room and he's with the guy. The guy doesn't even remember him, and there's no moment of rage or anything, but there's the conversation, and it winds up, well, you better not do it or I'll put a piece of radioactive something on your coffee cup and then you'll die from some disease and your whole face will melt off, and so don't let me ever catch you again. And then he leaves, and it's like, why we murder all these other people? Like, why were you murdering this guy? He's the guy who hired all the other murderers. I don't know, it doesn't make any sense, but whatever, he lives.
And he doesn't even have any sort of like internal, like, these type of people are guilty, these type of people are innocent, and you don't cross this particular line. Like, no, he makes a very clear point to not bring, you know, empathy and caring into his work, because that's just weakness and that people can take an advantage of. So, like, aside from potentially having to deal with, you know, a little bit more of a manhunt if you kill a famous guy, like, why would he not kill this guy, or kill, you know, break his neck, throw him down some stairs again? Like, why would he not kill this guy to cover up a loose end in a way that could potentially be untraceable to him?
Yeah, or just have the, you know, the poison or the, you know, speck of radiation or whatever there on you. But it seemed he just wanted to have the confrontation. But there's nothing rewarding about the confrontation for us in the audience or for the character. I don't know what closure he's supposed to get out of that, because he's leaving the room the same way he went in. Like, yeah, everything's the same.
If he were trying to turn over a new leaf because he had sort of come to some revelation that he's a different person than he actually thought he had been this entire time, where he was monologuing about himself to himself and he realized, like, oh, I'm not actually that guy. We don't see that turn. We don't have enough to feel that turn. So, like, it can't just be you kind of having a little bit of a laugh conversation, like, why did you try to kill my girlfriend? That wasn't cool. And the guy going, like, I didn't mean to try to kill your girlfriend, bro. I was just like, the guy said, do you want the, you know, the undercoating on the car? And I was like, sure.
Clean up on aisle three. So, yeah, but God, it's just so annoying, because we basically don't need any of the events of the film to actually occur. as the audience, there are no stakes here, because he's just on this personal mission to do this, but it is a revenge thing for the brute and for the expert, and Hedges, Dolores is collateral and so is Leo, but he's not in a better position at the end of the film than he was prior to the end of the film.
I mean, there are fewer people that know where he lives, basically.
Yeah, but he could have moved. like Hedges says, he's got all of the money. He's got passports. He's got credit cards. And we've seen him just cycle through them nonstop throughout the film. And I don't know if it's supposed to be funny with the names and stuff, but whatever. He's got resources and means. So he wasn't even doing this because he needed more money to retire or to get out of an organization or something. There's no motivating factor other than revenge for his girlfriend nearly dying. And I don't comprehend the significance of that for us as the audience, because who cares? Really, the guy's an assassin and he was sloppy. And there's no interrogation of that within himself in this film. He just goes and kills other assassins and then he goes home. And he doesn't need the rich guy's money to do it. He doesn't need to kill the rich guy. He doesn't, like, what was the benefit really of any of this?
I don't know.
So yeah, that's the whole film. For some reason it's 2 hours. And I just don't understand. I'm disappointed, greatly disappointed in your buddy, Mr. Yeah. David Fincher. And I don't understand what he was going for here. And I was especially perplexed when I looked at the Wikipedia page after watching this film. And I was like, surely there must be some sort of development explanation for how this happened.
I looked too.
Yeah. And the only explanation is that November of 2007, it was reported that David Fincher would be directing an adaptation of the Matz French comic book The Killer, with Alessandro Cammon writing the script, Brad Pitt's Plan B Entertainment producing, and Paramount Pictures distributing. By February of 2021, Fincher had taken the project to Netflix, where he had signed an overall deal with Andrew Kevin Walker, now writing the script, and Matthew Fassbender circling the lead role. By June, it was reported that Fincher was planning to begin filming in November 2021 in Paris with cinematographer Eric Messerschmidt. Tilda Swinton joined the cast in October. So, like, ta-da! They did it. They shot the movie. I don't know. Who cares?
Right. Like, there has to be more here. Like, if this movie is an extraordinarily low budget movie, it would almost benefit them to say that, because they could, you know, show what they did with their small budget. But he is known for making $150, $180 million thrillers. Like, that's what we've come to expect from him. And when you see this, you're like, this doesn't look like those other things. By the way, yeah, the things I sent you, as you can see, we are both right. some of them were LED. Some of them were green screen.
Well, I like that.
There's a few of them. There's more of them in the photos, but yeah.
Well, it looks like the night ones are the green screen ones. Mm. I'm sorry, the night ones are the LEDs ones. Probably because it doesn't get as bright, I guess.
I don't know. There's it also looks like a lot of the moped stuff. I mean, here, I can send you this one. It also, I mean, they probably just did this one because he wanted to have three cameras on him, and how are you going to do that practically?
Well, see, that's not one of the ones that bothered me. But those green screen ones where he's in the side there, it's just terrible. But And if you tell me there's a LED wall out that window where he's sitting with his gun, I'm going to eat my hat. Crow hat.
In the backseat with the taxi cab guy. I don't think I saw a behind the scenes of that one. Let me look one more time.
It's okay. It doesn't matter. It's just not convincing. And the fact that I'm even focusing on that kind of stuff tells you I'm really not invested in the story that's taking place here. I don't understand how they arranged for this to be premiered at the 80th Venice International Film Festival in September.
I mean, back up even further than that.
Yeah.
Why is this a script that David Fincher, of all people, said, this is good enough for me to shoot? I apologize for being rude and insulting because I know how hard it is to make movies, but this script, and again, yes, I like David Fincher, but this is not a movie that is up to his standards. Like, I don't find this script compelling. I don't know what he found compelling about it. I know he enjoys working with actors and characters, and it's kind of actually fascinating how many people in this movie have been in like no movies before this. So I'm sure there's something interesting about the fact that he's working with a lot of new talent here. But just looking at this thing on the whole, I'm like, I don't see what it is that drew him to this, because from all of the other movies that we have seen him make, he does these very unusual things centered around unusual people with unusual problems who are, you know, for lack of a better word, to use his word from some behind the scenes, perverse in some way. Like he makes his movies about not people like this. Like, I don't know how to describe, but not people like this, in his movies. So I don't know where the attraction came about this. I mean, maybe he just loved the comic book so much he had to take a swing at the feature version of it. This does not feel like the kind of story that would get the person that we have come to know from behind the scenes of those other movies, who is so detail oriented and opinionated and picky, to come out of his house for 5 months traveling around the world and making this movie. I don't understand that.
No. And I don't understand. I think the thing that really baffles me, was also after I watched this, I was like, is it just me? Like, am I crazy? Like, am I
am I wrong? No, it is the kids who are wrong.
Yeah. So I went on Letterboxd, and I was surprised to see a lot of people give it some pretty hefty 4.5-star reviews. And then I saw a lot of cowards who just marked it as watched. And I was like, you think you can get out of this? You think you're not going to get in trouble with the Fincher fans? So you're just going to mark it as watched. You're not going to write down what you actually thought. I just, what a mess this movie is. It's not that I am opposed to a Hitman movie or a revenge movie or anything, but just try, I guess. Like, how did this take so many years to make? And then it's like cliched and weird and boring and has nothing to do with like the art of cinema.
The script is the biggest culprit, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't even have words for the script. I will say, I watched this movie with my big fancy Apple headphones on, and it seems like the place that Fincher really leaned into this movie is the music and the sound design, because that feels like a Fincher movie to me. If you were to replace all of the score and sound design of this movie, it would be somebody else's movie. But the other thing I found very odd about this movie, and I don't know if you felt this too, it's cut at a pace that is a little bit too fast. And I don't know how to describe it better than I feel like Fincher is the kind of director who likes to let you linger on certain things in a way that just really sort of like puts extra emphasis on it. And the way it was cut a little bit more quickly here, it felt like a lot of that potential emphasis was removed. Like he will stay too long on something to make a point. Usually it's a person that you're meant to sort of be coming to some sort of realization about as you're moving into. And as we've discussed, we don't have a lot of that with anybody in this movie. Like we don't really get to know any of these characters. Like they're not changing in a way that we can grok on screen. And I can't say that it's entirely the editing cutting around that kind of stuff, but it's certainly like he used to use that as a way to emphasize certain things, and it feels like that's missing from this movie. And I don't really know how to articulate it all that well, other than to say the editing did not feel like a David Fincher movie either. Not to say that it was bad; it felt at odds with the way he likes to shoot things. I'll
help you out here. It feels conventional.
Sure.
In a way, because this is what you would expect from a middle of the road kind of movie like this. Is like things happen, they cut from thing to thing. There's a, you know, they're in a cab. So they have the shot of Michael Fassbender in the back of the cab. They have a shot of Leo in the front of the cab. They cut back and forth. They do it quickly. There's no long shot of the two of them where we're going back and forth slowly between them to build tension. It's cut, 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 cut.
As I've clicked on a link here, mm-hmm. I am additionally confused because this is the same editor as The Social Network, Gone Girl, Benjamin Button, and Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. So, and Mindhunter too. And Mank, like all of his stuff, all of his movies are here. I don't know what's going on with this movie.
No, I just think it's on purpose. I think he's making a more conventional film here. It's just not good, but I think he's doing it on purpose. I don't think it's an accident. That's why I was joking about like a second unit.
Trying to give people credit for doing things intentionally, or you know, there must be some reason behind it. I mean, so many of the hallmarks of his movies are, you know, he does the things that he does, which seem odd at first for a very specific reason, and people have dug into the psychology behind his movies, and you know, so like, no, this is actually a genius thing that he's doing right here that you just haven't quite, you know, put together, or like you're just, it's not like your kind of thing or whatever. But I cannot square this movie with the man that we have come to know from all of his other movies. It just does not like it. I don't want to say it feels like he phoned it in, but it feels like the kind of person who has changed his opinions about the way movies should be made, and nothing about what we have come to know about him previously seems to leave any sort of like room for him to change his mind on some of these things. Like, I don't know why he would reverse the way he's made movies for years and years and years because he suddenly thinks this is a better way to do it. Like I can't put the two together. Like, this is not the same David Fincher as the one that we had known before. And obviously it is. And like, this is just my perception or whatever. Like, he can do whatever the hell he wants because he's him and this is the way he wants to make this movie. I just don't know why he was drawn to this movie and why he decided to make it this way.
I have a theory, and I'm only inferring this theory from the bare minimum of facts that are available about the behind the scenes that we've come across so far. And that is just that this is a project that he liked initially and sat in development hell because he didn't know how to make it. And then when he signed his big lucrative overall deal with Netflix, he needed to make something. And so this is one of the things that he brought over. And this is during COVID protocols. So this is something that can be shot with a minimum cast of characters interacting at the same time. So that could have been a motivating factor. And think about the timeline where they have it brought over to Netflix by February 2021, and then they're shooting in November 2021 in Paris. So that's a pretty quick turnaround on rewriting whatever it was that was the movie.
Yeah. I don't want to lay this at the feet of COVID, but that it is very possible that they said, what is the version of this movie that we can make right now? Maybe Netflix begged him, like, please shoot this movie in 2021, however you're able. And maybe that's how this thing went down. I just can't picture David Fincher as any kind of guy other than the kind of guy who would say, absolutely fuck off, I'm not going to do that just to make a movie. Like, that's not, that doesn't sound like the guy who made all of these other excruciatingly detailed movies about psychotic people doing horrible things. But again, whatever, practicalities. Like, COVID changed a lot of things and a lot of people. So maybe he just decided this is one for Netflix and we'll get this out of our system. But given how infrequently he takes projects, it is just surprising to me that this is the next project that came from him.
Well, also surprising is that they wrapped their shooting in March of 2022, and then it sat for more than a year in post so that it could premiere at the Venice Film Festival.
I mean, there's a lot of green screens. You got a key there, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, they, as we've discussed, they were not spending that time doing quality work. I will say that they were spending, whoever was hired to do this was hired to do it probably on a quick turnaround or with a low budget. And I feel bad for them for making being critical of their work here, but it's not very good.
And this is an extraordinarily small visual effects credit section on IMDb.
There's no way this took a year to do in post. Maybe it took a year to turn Michael Fassbender's skin green in color. But yeah,
there's 35 people.
Sounds about right.
Wow, and that includes the title company. What? I'm so confused. And I don't know any of these companies either.
Mm. And I just did it on the cheap, I guess. There is a box office number that is quoted on the Wikipedia page that I don't like quite understand.
$380,000 or something?
Yeah, $362,113. I don't fully comprehend that. I guess. Is that, I don't know. I mean,
how long was it actually in theaters?
I was trying to find out what the budget for this was.
I would love to know. I haven't seen it anywhere.
No, it was released in theaters for like a week or something, I think, according to this. Limited theatrical released October 27th. And then streaming on the platform November 10th. So it's just a week basically of being in movie theaters. There's no way it made a $362,000 in a week. I don't know where they got that number, but I don't get it. I don't understand what's going on here. This is one of those things that I get so perturbed with Netflix about, where they're making just very mediocre to poor movies and TV shows just so they can churn out stuff, and it doesn't feel like there's any quality control guiding any of this, either from Fincher or from Netflix, and I don't understand why. It really feels like commerce in a like dirty way, and not like in a fun, we're all making money, being happy way, you know, not like Barbie. This is just like kind of unpleasant. Because the end result is just kind of not good. And I don't understand how all those things came together. It's not even like we've been saying, it's not one thing. It's not like there was just, oh yeah, you guys, you messed up this one thing. This one sequence is weird. The third act falls apart, whatever. It's just like, no, this whole movie from the time it starts to the time it ends is not very good. And I don't understand how all of that could be so thoroughly not very good. And maybe they tried to fix it in the edit for a year. I have no idea.
No, I don't think they did. The edit to me feels like someone on Netflix saying, can you make this 25 minutes shorter?
Yeah. I mean, God, though, I can't imagine a longer version of this movie. I don't think
there needs to be a longer version. I do think it could have used a little bit more air in places to actually add some emphasis to things that needed emphasis that they just sort of like, well, we're moving on now. Just in the way that he's done some of that stuff in the past. But what is the shot I'm thinking of? Before I forget, I do want to mention, you know, some of the cinematography that I really liked. You know, when he's actually in the elevator on his way up to go grab Dolores or whatever, I really kind of liked the way his hat is like perfectly shadowing his face just so you can like never actually see him. You know, I think they do a lot of good stuff with just the right amount of light and shadows covering things and just creating a sort of moody look and, you know, the assassin sort of hiding in between shadows where he can. I liked that stuff here. There wasn't, you know, quite a ton of it, but when I did see it, it was nice looking.
I suppose. I think the music, which you already touched on, was interesting to me. I'm curious to listen to the soundtrack outside of the film. I like Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's score for The Social Network, but I don't love all of their scores. This just kind of feels like it sits in the background to kind of like boost the movie.
It does feel more like sound design than soundtrack a lot of times.
Yeah. And the movie heavily leans on the Smiths. And I'm not as huge the Smiths fan, but is an interesting choice. What I thought was strange though is I'm Only Human by the Smiths or whatever, the one's the Charm theme song. When that one came on, I was just like, this is the Charm theme song. It took me right out of the movie. And I just have to be like, didn't someone say to David Fincher, you gotta use a different song? Like, no, you can't use that one.
I think, you know, somebody smarter than me, you know, put it on the Letterboxd review. I forget who it was that, you know, you've got this like unfeeling killer, who uses some of the most like, emotive pop music of the '80s to sort of disassociate, is kind of a fun, contrast to his absurd character. But yeah, it is a bit, silly. Basically the whole movie is just the Smiths.
Yeah. Also his like, the use of the Fitbit here, it just doesn't amount to anything. But we have a lot of weird technology again, like the MP3 player and
stuff. It's just another way to see that he's like slipping, like he can't get his heart rate where it's supposed to be and these sorts of things. But again, it never really comes back around.
No, it's not like the final scene with the guy in his penthouse. It's not like it came down to that. It wasn't all hinged on his heartbeat. We never dealt with his heartbeat again after the brute. That was the final moment. He hangs it up on the little rearview mirror. He goes and he does his thing, and I guess he retrieved it from the rearview mirror. But we don't talk about it again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, he's moving past it. He doesn't need his restraint or his cold, unfeeling, slow heart rate. He's gonna use his energy and go, you know, get revenge or whatever. It's an odd miss for me, for Mr. Fincher. I'm still an unrepentant fan of his work,
obviously, because he still gave it 3.5 stars.
I mean, again, I feel like I have to explain my scale. 3.5 means better than fine. 3 means fine. And again, the reason it gets better than fine is because of the craft on display here with the filmmakers. The script is like a 2. Like, I swear, I could not imagine what words were on the page where somebody went, ooh, that's an interesting take on an assassin story. Unless they were just like, you know, Fincher and Fassbender were so horny to make a movie together because they never got to do Steve Jobs or something. Like, I'm glad they got to do something together. I'm a little disappointed that it's this.
Yeah. I mean, and I really like Fassbender, as we've talked about when we've had to watch the execrable Covenant and the, what was the other one?
Prometheus.
Prometheus. We had to watch those trash fires. He was the best parts of those movies, but he has a very comprehensive ability to act in a wide range, and we don't get to see any of it. It is kind of a waste to employ him in this role. This could have been Thomas Jane for all it mattered. It's like this, just a robot. Just
I don't know that Thomas robot. Jane could have provided what Fincher was looking for in this particular role. But again, what Fincher is looking for is somebody who is stone-faced the majority of the time.
Dude, we never, I definitely remember talking to you about it, but did we ever watch The Punisher, the Tampa one?
Oh, yeah. With Thomas Jane? Oh, yeah, we did.
Yeah. Okay. Just making sure. Oh, right. Yeah, because we were talking about John Travolta a lot. Yeah. All right, so, anyway.
His eyebrows are just too dramatic in that movie to slot into something like this.
yeah, I don't know. It's just like, why is this a movie? no one seemed to answer that question.
And we can't answer it either. I genuinely want to know that question. Like, not in like a provoking, internet troll kind of way. Like, I want to hear what it was about this movie that attracted David Fincher.
If you were in a press conference with David Fincher and light bulbs are going off from people's cameras and you have your press hat on with a little word that says press on the side and you're handed a microphone to hold up to David Fincher and ask him one question, what would your question be about this movie?
About this particular movie?
This particular movie.
I would say I would ask him what drew him to this particular story.
It gives him too many weasel.
Yeah, he's going to weasel out of it because is it a press conference or whatever? He's not going to tell me to fuck off in front of 500 other people.
Do you just want him to tell you to fuck off?
No, that's the kind of person that he has presented to us over the years. Like, remember the emails? Remember the like the sarcasm to the executives at studios where he's just kind of like a I'm not going to play your game, get the hell out of here kind of person. And yet now we're watching this movie going, this is not that guy.
Yeah.
This is not the guy who like quickly and openly mocked Adam Driver for being cast in Star Wars.
Wow. That was courageous of him to do that.
I mean, but that's just like, he's a dick. Like, He is in no mood to take anyone's crap, let alone studio people. So, like, what is it about this movie that was something for him to go like, ooh, I got to get back out there, and this is the movie I want to do it with. Like, I understand that Mank was a miss for a lot of people, but that was a personal story for him written by his dad. Like, you got to let that one go. That one doesn't count on the scoreboard.
You're not going to make me watch that one, are you?
I am not going to make you watch that one because that would further emphasize the results we got from this movie, whereas I want you to watch some of the other movies that are glorious, horrifying masterpieces that are difficult to watch but are expertly crafted, but are just going to make you real unhappy and uncomfortable.
Okay.
I'm talking primarily about Dragon Tattoo. It's such a good movie, and it is like so just awful content-wise.
Did he do the sequel to that one, or did someone else do that one?
Somebody else did that one.
Okay.
Because again, like, it's a movie about like a detective in this weird Scandinavian world and just like messed up stuff happening that they spent like $150 million making. Like, that's not a thing that people at studios are really all that willing to entertain these days. So it's possible that the kind of movies that David Fincher likes to make just aren't really being made anymore because he wants the money to make them in a way that he wants to make them. And people are just going to say, get out of here. I'm not going to give you $150 million to make a movie about like four people. Like, that's insane that you need that. And he's like, well, I need to shoot for 90 days. I need to have these giant VFX budgets. I need to have this very specific equipment. Cause that's just like the way he likes to make his movies. I hate to say that he kind of needs those things to achieve the goals he wants, but like he certainly didn't get them here.
All right. Well, on that chipper note, I think we're done here. We can wrap it up.
We've killed the killer.
Kill not, lest ye be killed.
Yeah, I'm just looking through his credits right now. I would have rather watched The Game again than this.
I hate The Game.
at least it's interesting for a while. Even if it, like, even if the movie doesn't seem to really know where it's going, we're also kind of confused. Whereas in this one, we're like, I know what's happening here.
Yeah, I just...
just don't like Michael Douglas and Sean Penn. No,
I mean, they're not great in it, really. They're kind of annoying. But just the third act really not just falls apart, but, like, let's just say it falls off a building.
Yeah.
And I don't.
He admits as much about that one.
I don't like that. I feel like you can't be like, ah, oh, this is such a clever thriller movie. And then it's just like, oh, but it didn't mean anything anyways. And then it all just, like, whatever. Stuff happens. Da-da-da-da-da-da. End. And it's just like, you can't do that. You can't do that. It makes me so angry.
See, like, this is the first time where I feel like I feel bad that I'm not enforcing the Joe Steele rules when it comes to a David Fincher movie. I feel like if you would have watched in sequence Zodiac, Social Network, Dragon Tattoo, Gone Girl, you would have just felt like me, the monumental cliff that he fell off for this movie. And it's just so freaking weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this time period with Netflix, I don't know what's going on. Because, like, he had, what was it? They didn't formally announce that Manhunter was canceled yet or something, right? Yeah. And then they did. But... you know, Fincher has a complicated relationship with Netflix, and I don't know what exactly motivates him to go to them over more traditional studios. I mean, I can understand what would motivate anyone to get away from
Paramount.
I mean,
it started with House of Cards. They're just like, do whatever you feel like doing. Here's a bunch of money. It's like, all right, you know, I don't love doing low budget, extremely expensive television, but I'll take this one on. And it became extremely popular. So, you know, they kind of struck their overall deal kind of thing.
Yeah, but then after that, what compels him to make an overall deal with Netflix and release The Killer there and presumably keep releasing other films through Netflix? Like, what does he like that?
I mean, in previous years, I would have said it's because they give him the freedom to do what he wants to do and they don't interfere the way a studio would. But again, now that this is the result of reducing the interference from a studio.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
And I mean, it's pretty intangible what it is that a studio really brings to the table when you're thinking about it. You're like, oh, man, they're really messing it up. Like, they don't really just let artists be artists. And it's just like, well, you know, sometimes people make some oopsies. I don't know if he's like in a George Lucas moment right now where he has no one to tell him no or something. But, like,
you just don't generally. Yeah. I mean, I was just about to make a broad generalization that people don't generally sort of get less quirky with age, but I suppose people sort of lose a little bit of the edge to them as they age. So maybe this is him losing a little bit of that edge after a number of years. I mean, because it's been 9 years since Gone Girl, and, you know, Gillian, whatever her name is, Flynn, brought a lot to that movie from the original story. So who's to say that he wasn't starting to curb a little bit there? But the fact that he was drawn to that story and went like, oh, this is my kind of stuff. Like, you know, that guy choosing such a mundane assassin movie here. I don't know, man. Not to say that I had the greatest sense of him as a human being before this, but it just doesn't seem like the same filmmaker.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what they say, this is a filmmakers get checks and sometimes they bounce, baby, et cetera. Yeah.
Who says that?
It's a blank check podcast. It was a joke. Yeah, because I don't know if he's got a blank check now to do whatever he wants at Netflix. And if this is whatever he wants, then that's kind of sad. To do less of what you want, I guess. But yeah, I mean, people get old. They've got to go to PTA meetings. They've got, you know, stuff to do. Like, they don't necessarily quite have the vim and vigor to do what they might have in the past. Yeah, sometimes, you know, people lose their edge. And we lost our edge. We have no edge. We're edgeless.
We've never had edge. We're not.
Yeah.
We're not.
We don't have edge. We don't have Bono. We don't have anything.
I don't have those silly hats that he wears.
They keep his head warm. I'd rather you know, just not have any of these problems that I'm sure David Fincher has, but he will just manage to somehow keep making money through it, and we'll see what he does through it at the end of this process, whenever that Netflix overall deal ends. There are a lot of people who have overall deals with Netflix who ended up making not a whole heck of a lot, and then taking that money and hitting the road. So maybe that is part of his overall strategy. I have no idea. But whatever. Take his filthy lucre right now. And that's it. We're done.
I guess we'll see in another 3 years what the next project is that comes out.
You think it'll only be three?
It's been three since Mank, but before that, I guess it was six for Gone Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got Mindhunter in there too. Mindhunter was a bit, I mean, and that's the other thing too. Like, one of the main reasons he said he wanted to stop doing Mindhunter is because it required so much of his effort. It was like a 9 month, 18 hour a day, 7 days a week kind of job to put together a season of that show. And you're like, it kind of looks like it. Like, there's a lot of work going into this project, and that's why people like it. And it's a little bit of a bummer that the showrunner goes like, this, I'm tired and I don't want to do that anymore. But you kind of understand it a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, and then you can also do the thing that a lot of other showrunners do where they say, hey, I'm going to delegate this to other people and not be a control freak.
Yeah. But then you got this guy who's like, I would rather shut this down than let somebody make a crappier version of it. He obviously didn't have the control over Dragon Tattoo for them to not make another crappier version of that. But yeah, like if the guy is going to say, screw you, you're not making a worse version of my show without me. And then he's going to go on and do a movie like this, where it feels like nobody was really stressing themselves to make this thing happen. I don't know, man. I don't know how many different ways I can say I don't understand this movie. So we should just talk about something else.
No, well, that's why I keep trying to say we're done.
Yeah, we're done. We've been done. We've done. Market done. Market zero a million years ago. When you said we killed the movie or whatever you said, just cut it there.
But then you kept talking about the movie.
Cut it off. Nobody cares.
You have to stop talking about the movie.
We don't have to keep talking. I mean, people can, can miss this part.
Nope. Nope. No more movie.
David Fincher.